The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, what a paradox it is that with almost everyone expecting war in the Mideast at any moment, the big powers pour arms into the oil-producing countries, with the United States one of the heaviest traffickers in arms worldwide, and at the same time, U.S. leaders speak of possible armed intervention in the Middle East in case of the so-called strangulation of the West, meaning any new Arab oil embargoes, or at least a diminution in oil supplies or additional heightened cost of that precious energy source. And now, not only are the big powers involved, but Europe is increasingly becoming involved in Middle Eastern affairs. Many years ago, in traveling about over Europe and talking to leaders of various Western European countries, not the least of which is West Germany, I was asking questions about eventual European involvement in the Middle East, wondering, in the light of protracted American involvement in Vietnam, and the unwillingness of the American public to accept any more interference or involvement in faraway places as far as U.S. troop commitments were concerned, obviously still a very volatile political and social or domestic issue in the United States. The committing of troops abroad would be almost the death knell of any president in office. And so I would ask European leadership, Franz Josef Strauss among them, would you contemplate, in the eventuality of a renewed war in the Middle East, especially talking about that precious energy source, which is the very life's blood of all the Western European industrial powers, any armed intervention from a multilateral European force in the Middle East? At that time, 6, 8, 10 years ago, I received one denial after another. And now, suddenly, times have changed. Everybody is getting into the Middle Eastern act. It's an incredible merry-go-round of unbelievable paradoxical irony in the Middle East these days, with the big powers involved directly, with Israel and the Arab nations around Israel, with Russia supporting Syria, Iraq, other North African Arab states, the United States supposedly supporting Israel, and meanwhile leading United States senators, among them Senator Percy, are doing a complete turnaround and now saying that Israel should withdraw to behind the pre-1967 borders, including giving up eastern Jerusalem. Not only a little bit step by step in the Sinai, but now giving up the Golan Heights, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and all of the Sinai. So when you say the United States is supporting Israel, you have to qualify that a little bit. But in the meantime, the United States is selling an incredible amount of arms to Arab countries. And if you will write for the current number, the second edition of our new tabloid, Plain Truth, coming out in February, you're going to see articles that will absolutely stand your hair on end about exactly what is going on in the Middle East. In my Speaks Out column, for example, I ask the question, the United States is interested in arms limitations, right? It's interested in peace in the world and in a halt to this international flow and traffic in arms. Is that right? No, that's wrong. The United States is the biggest trafficker in arms the world has ever seen. And when you really begin to see what is happening in the Middle East, and even look at the tragic comic thing I wrote about the young recruit who is being spoken to by his burly DI in the Marine Corps base at maybe Quantico or perhaps Camp Pendleton, who is telling the young Marine Corps boot, well, son, we're going to send you first of all to Lebanon where you can learn to use those new TOW anti-tank weapons. The kid might say, well, look, Sarge, how come I can't learn that right here at Camp Pendleton? He might say, well, you see, we've got to sell those TOWs to 14 nations and give them away to at least two others before we can get our hands on any. The Marine Corps has to wait until next December to get theirs. Oh, sure, Sarge, I understand. Well, then where do I go next? Well, then next you're going to go to Saudi Arabia to learn how to operate those new attack helicopters that are so super sophisticated they can operate in near zero visibility weather. They're helicopter gunships with rockets aboard and the search and destroy radar equipment. Well, you read the rest of the story, but it'll absolutely stand your wig on end when you hear how much we are pouring arms into the Middle East. Here are a few cases in point. From a world expenditure of about $300 million in arms in 1952, world trade in arms rose to $5 billion by 1969 and will total about $18 billion this fiscal year alone. That's a 6,000% increase over 1952. And in current terms of dollars spent from 61 to 71, the United States supplied nearly $23 billion in major weapon systems to 74 countries. And you know how irritated we get about the Soviet Union supplying arms to the Arabs? All those supersonic, sophisticated aircraft, MiG-23s, to Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria, Iraq. What about Egypt? And Anwar Sadat recently touring France in a weapons-buying trip over there and decrying the fact that, as he said, and I took exception to that on the radio program, that the Soviet Union had not yet, quote, compensated, end quote, the Egyptians for their losses in the last war. Oh, yes, we get awfully uptight. We think back in recent history about the Soviet Union arming, supplying arms for the North Koreans, for the North Vietnamese, for the Cambodian insurgents. Well, let me tell you, here's a comparison. The Soviet Union, in that same period of time, the decade from 61 to 71, spent $15 billion in arms and delivered those arms to 37 countries. The United States spent $23 billion and delivered its arms to 74 countries. Now, you judge the right or the wrong of that. I'm just quoting the facts. Now, you're going to read those facts in the current number of The Plain Truth, and you're going to see some awfully strong commentary just about where all these facts are leading us. And the two superpowers that scream for arms limitation and for SALT talks and for Geneva Conventions and for limitations in nuclear weapons are at the same time, with one hand held up in the air, stop the flow of arms, are greedily trafficking in arms up into the tens of billions of dollars. And most people don't seem to know very much about that. You can take a look at the incredible irony of the unbelievable amount of money we spent in the United States for our ABM system deployment. That's the anti-missile missiles that gave rise to a lot of comedy and a kind of a play on words when we discussed the arrival of a new generation of anti-missile missiles. Then we talked about the Russians having their anti-missile missiles, and we went on and on with that for a while. But it all spelled out finally billions upon billions of taxpayers' dollars for the latest and most sophisticated weapons to be deployed in their missile silos in various locations around the United States as a part of the DEW line. So the idea was that these huge super-powered booster rockets of the Soviet Union that could boost giant payloads into space with multi-megaton nuclear warheads could be intercepted by deployment of anti-missile missiles or anti-ballistic missiles, thus the ABM system, and it cost billions of dollars. Well, now we hear of the recent accord reached, at least in verbal agreement, between the Soviet party chief Leonid Brezhnev and Mr. Gerald Ford, that is going to lead toward firming up documents which will halt, or at least limit in some way, this frantic race toward more and more arms. It will, in short, allow the Soviet Union to catch up with its deployment of MIRV. That's those multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles. That's the short form for that. MIRV, that means many multi-megaton warheads composed in one missile. The Russians didn't have any of those. Those weren't deployed yet. So the United States halts its number of MIRVs right where we are, and we allow the Soviet Union to catch up in their MIRV. They halt their big super booster rockets right where they are and allow us to catch up. However, it now becomes obvious that the ABM system we were all sold, the billions upon billions of dollars it cost, the only defense against the Russian super rockets, are now rendered obsolete because we allow them to catch up in MIRVs, and with MIRVs there just isn't any kind of ABM system that would ever be effective in stopping an attack from multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, and that's kind of a mouthful. You'll read some of that type of thing in The Plain Truth, too. It will keep you abreast of what is really happening in world conditions as it is fulfilling biblical prophecy. Well, let me tell you what's happening right now. The objective that the United States seems to have in allowing bits and dribbles, if you can call 100 tanks here and a few hundred aircraft there, into Middle Eastern Arab hands surrounding Israel, is to assist in obtaining rights and authorizations for facility arrangements at various locations for U.S. forces. It's to maintain a certain military balance, obviously, in the Middle East. It's to create conditions that are requisite for an ultimate truce of some sort to kind of lead Arab neighbors in Israel toward a standoff. It's obviously to foster favorable attitudes. You don't go around promising Egypt nuclear reactors and lots of weapons unless you're trying to foster some kind of a favorable attitude toward the United States on the part of those oil countries. Now, you don't want to really draw the analogy of prostitution in any of this. You hate to think of a person that is literally peddling their wares on the street and saying, it's not a matter of my character, it's just a matter of what we're talking about in terms of dollars. But believe it or not, just the other day, I saw such an analogy drawn in a newspaper article. And it was interesting to me because it is exactly the analogy that is used in the Bible. Of any nation that calls itself by the name of God, that prints on its bills, "In God we trust," that has the name of God in its salute to the flag, that is a nation founded on the precepts of religious freedom, a nation whose president is a believer in God and who refers to a divine power in his most sober moments of speech-making, including his inaugural address, and yet at the same time, when it comes right down to who we depend on and where we place our faith, it's in the lovers we can buy. You know, J. Paul Getty should have taught us a lesson. He once said that he would give all of his millions, I guess billions, he's a multi-billionaire, I understand, for just one happy marriage. And multimillionaires learn there's one thing money cannot buy. It cannot buy true friends. It cannot buy love. You can't buy happiness with money. You can't buy health. There are a lot of things you can't buy with money. But one thing is you cannot buy true lovers. Oh, you can rent them, but you can't buy them. And the United States doesn't know that. And we're trying to buy lovers. We see that there is hostility, and we see that if we just continue to support Israel alone and pour limitless amounts of conventional weapons into Israel, that sooner or later, given enough time, the Arabs are going to overwhelm Israel, and we will have been fighting a losing game. But at the same time, we don't want to give up our toys, and we've got to have that Arab oil. Oh, I know President Nixon, prior to his resignation, came up with a big program about self-sufficiency and how we're going to be completely independent in energy by 1980. Well, it was only a matter of months before Mr. Nixon himself had to kind of back down on that. Now nobody even talks about that anymore. We proved that we had to continue to, in effect, prostitute ourselves for that oil we get from the oil-rich countries over there. And now it seems we are willing to sell out almost anybody to do it. Now we see leading senators virtually turning around and doing a 180-degree turnabout on their approach toward Israel. It's a strange set of affairs when you see the United States selling to the Saudi Arabians 60 jet fighters for $750 million, when you see F-14, some of those super sophisticated twin-tail swing-wing fighters that were developed recently for the U.S. Navy, and even before some of our own military forces can get these sophisticated weapons, they're being sent over to the Middle East. We're giving anti-tank missiles to Lebanon while we send tanks to the Israelis. And those anti-tank missiles, by the way, can be carried by ground forces. And we're also sending anti-aircraft missiles, the Hawk missiles, over there to Lebanon. Government officials, as I said in a program a week or so ago, must have a higher mentality than we do as laymen. They reason differently because their explanations are so profound. In the midst of the recent announcement to send these anti-tank missiles and the improvement of the sale to Jordan of Hawk anti-aircraft missiles, Defense Department sources said, and I quote, U.S. government officials said the decisions were intended to contribute to a climate of stability and as a stimulus to Middle East peace negotiations between the Arabs and Israel. That would be exactly like saying the Black Panthers had just purchased a shipment of submachine guns, and the police, in order to retaliate, had been delivered a whole shipment of bazookas. But there's no reason to worry about your community where they're holed up, because that's going to contribute to a climate of stability and as a stimulus to peace negotiations between the Panthers and the police. You believe that? And even little Oman is getting some anti-tank missiles, and it's known that South Yemen has been supplied by at least 50 Russian tanks. And, of course, you heard about the aircraft carrier the Saudi Arabia is going to get for its attack helicopters, and the fact that the new Forrestal destroyer cannot even be delivered to our own Navy for a year or two because we've got to sell about five or six to some of the Arab countries. So it's amazing. Even when Northrop lost out on its pact for a new Air Force lightweight fighter, it was not really disturbed because one of the leaders of Northrop found encouragement in the possibility of extensive foreign sales of this twin-engine fighter aircraft, the YF-16, I believe it was. The YF-17 Cobra was the Northrop, rather, and the 16 was the General Dynamics, which was chosen. But they're now looking toward worldwide foreign sales that could boost that market of theirs by about 300% to a total of 4,000 aircraft, and those aren't slated for delivery in the United States. Well, it's unbelievable what is happening in the Middle East, and it's unbelievable how much prophecy is about to be fulfilled. The very fact that Matthew 24, Luke 21 zero in on Jerusalem, armies surrounding Jerusalem, and on involvement from a king of the north, which is a European power in the Middle East. At the same time, America, as well as the Soviet Union, pour arms into that area, and both of them get in the act to try to bring about peace. It doesn't seem to me that it makes any sense whatsoever. I asked years ago then, because I knew biblical prophecy says eventually a European power is going to become involved in the Middle East. And I asked European leaders if that was a potentiality. Well, even now, from Brussels, we're seeing European leaders, in this case it was Kurt Waldheim, who was Secretary General of the United Nations, who was over there at NATO headquarters and at Common Market headquarters in Brussels recently, and from the Common Market headquarters he spoke out on the possibility of European involvement at some time in the Middle East. And we have a report that was filed just before I came on the air from Brussels. I'd like now to take you to Brussels and Ray Kosanke.
This is Ray Kosanke in Brussels. Are we about to see a European initiative in the Middle East? Europe is seeking a mediating role in the Middle East, even if it doesn't quite know how to go about it. Last week in Paris, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat spoke out in reference to security in the Middle East, stating that Western Europe had a role to play in this field, especially France. In Belgium, Prime Minister Leo Tindemans also wondered aloud if now was not the time for a European initiative in that part of the world. I asked United Nations Secretary General Kurt Waldheim this morning here in Brussels if he felt the Europe of Nine had a role to play in the Middle East, and if so, what kind of role he felt was appropriate. His response.
I think that Europe should play an important role in the efforts to achieve a settlement in the Middle East. And the way to do it, well, this is a very difficult question, but I would say that the best way of doing it is to exercise their influence on both sides of the conflict to be more conciliatory, to understand each other better, and in this way to contribute to the efforts undertaken now by other parties to achieve a political breakthrough.
It is interesting to note that the European Economic Community is increasingly in a position to do just that, to exercise influence on both sides of the conflict. Just last month, the European Community signed a protocol agreement with Israel and the three Arab states of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. This protocol will be a fully ratified treaty next month, meaning an important trade agreement for the nations concerned. Already, the Community's Commission has proposed trade negotiations with four more Arab countries, those directly around Israel, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. With the United Nations mandates in the Sinai and the Golan Heights ready to run out in April and late May, respectively, Europe is getting itself increasingly involved in the world's greatest crisis area. Mr. Waldheim underlined the danger this morning.
What is important now, and here I want to be very firm, what is important now is a breakthrough in the political negotiations to make some, even if it's only limited progress, in order to maintain the momentum of negotiations. The great danger we are faced with today in the Middle East is that we are losing the momentum, and that then people, the parties directly involved, get desperate again, and that is the greatest danger, because it could lead to another war.
This is Ray Kosanke at Common Market Headquarters in Brussels.
And so at last, you see, leaders of such stature as Kurt Waldheim, whose heavily accented English may be a little difficult for some to understand, speak out on the fact of European powers exercising influence on both sides of the conflict, and a protocol agreement, including Israel and neighboring Arab states, for trade beginning to flow back and forth between European countries and the Arabs and the Israelis alike. In maintaining that momentum, some of the famous shuttle diplomacy of Henry Kissinger is about to occur again, a long-awaited and long-expected trip by Henry Kissinger right down into Jerusalem is in the offing almost immediately. And I received this report from my son Mark Armstrong, who was on the spot, also delivered by telephone from Jerusalem just before coming on the air.
Mark Armstrong, Jerusalem. U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger is due here in Jerusalem next week in a new round of his now famous shuttle diplomacy. He will try to bring about an agreement between Israel and Egypt for a settlement in Sinai. Mr. Kissinger has stated that he would not be visiting the Middle East at this time if he did not feel there was some possibility of progress. Yesterday, Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko visited Syria and held a five-hour conference with President Assad. The meeting resulted in a joint communique calling for immediate resumption of the Geneva Conference, at which the Soviets would be co-chairmen with the United States. Syria is against any separate negotiations between Israel and Egypt. Gromyko spent today in Egypt in talks with President Sadat in an attempt to influence the Egyptian attitude toward Kissinger's upcoming visit and push for early resumption of the Geneva Conference. Sadat has recently restated the Egyptian position that Israel must withdraw from the Arab lands within 3 months, or they will go to Geneva and, quote, explode everything there. Even Mr. Kissinger apparently believes that an eventual return to the Geneva Conference may be necessary for an overall and lasting settlement in the entire area. But the feeling is that unless some progress is made ahead of the conference to get it off to a good start, it will fail miserably and increase the potential for war. This is Mark Armstrong, Jerusalem.
And so the increased potential for warfare daily is fueled by the United States and the Soviet Union, while leaders of both these superpowers are traveling to the Middle East to talk to Arab and Israeli leadership alike. It's a strange, ironic paradox that with almost everyone expecting war in the Middle East at any moment, the big powers continue to pour weapons into the area. Obviously, in the sense of Europe and the United States, very interested in the continuing flow of that vital source of energy that is Arab oil, and willing to virtually, pardon my language, but it's biblical language, prostitute ourselves in selling any amount of arms, even before our own armed services can get their hands on those arms, and at the same time standing for peace and saying we hope to see breakthroughs in negotiations and we hope to see a diffusing of the situation in the Middle East. All of this will be explored in the current number of The Plain Truth. You will see the incredible information of this outpouring of American arms into the Middle East, and you will see exactly where we go from here. Twice a month, The Plain Truth in tabloid size, coming out with 30, 40 articles, short and readable. You can sit down and read any number of them on subjects ranging all the way from crime, the economy, your physical personal health, your personal finances, problems from around the world of feeding the hungry million, the incredible human potential of your own mind and your own ability in the future. A new series my father is starting, an article on prophecy, and we have the second edition just about ready to come off the press as I talk to you now. And we've increased circulation by hundreds of thousands, target 5 million circulation and more in the first couple of years. Your copy, absolutely free of charge, will be in the mail the minute we receive your request for it. And some of this same information you're getting on The World Tomorrow on radio, as well as the program on television, will be in each copy of the Plain Truth magazine. Let me catch you up to date quickly on just a few prophecies in the Bible that bear on this same area of the world. In Luke 21 and in verse 20, Jesus said, "When you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh." And then he talked about a flight to the mountains on the part of those who live in Judea, and the days of vengeance were the time just before a gigantic world war. Now all of that is underlined in the 11th chapter of Daniel, beginning in verse 40. It talks about a king of the north who is a result of something that is described as pushing at him. Not an armed attack, not aggression, but something that is a jostling match, a shoving match on the part of politicians. And it says when the king of the south, and it's interesting that there is a king over one of the most important and one of the most powerful nations in the Arab sphere, and that is King Faisal of Saudi Arabia. And also interesting that in the Persian language, the word Shah means king. And the Shah of Iran is a man in a hurry with visions of grandeur, not unlike that of Charles de Gaulle, except the Shah of Iran goes a little further back in history so far as his desire for a new Persian empire. And he's got the money. He's out shopping for super sophisticated arms to make Iran one of the largest powers in that part of the world, and perhaps even challenging eventually some of the superpowers from whom the Shah of Iran is buying his weapons. So here you see today, throughout all of North Africa, the immediate Arab neighbors all around Jerusalem or Israel, and even as far away as Iran, non-Arab, but nevertheless Muslim in religion, all of them armed to the teeth, and here is biblical prophecy saying that the spark which will ignite a nuclear World War III will be ignited in the Middle East. Jesus said there's a spiritual aspect to it, too. He said in Matthew 24, "When you shall therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place," that's Jerusalem, and he says, "Whoso reads, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains." The same statement coming just before a time of flight on the part of those who live in the city of Jerusalem. And that message has got to be taken to the people who literally live there in Jerusalem. So there's going to be a great church intervention in the Middle East as well. A great spiritual and religious figure, as well as a great political and military figure who will intervene in that part of the world. Here's one prophecy in the third chapter of Joel that seems to be fulfilled right now. It says in chapter 3 and verse 9, "Proclaim you this among the nations," it says Gentiles, the better translation is nations, "prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up, beat your plowshares into swords, and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong." And one formerly weak little country after another is now being able to flex its muscles with arms delivered directly from the United States, from the Soviet Union, from France, or other weapons suppliers in the Middle East. You need to keep your eye on the Middle East, and the best way to watch is not only to continue to listen to The World Tomorrow on radio and watch the telecast, but also to get your name on the mailing list as soon as you can of The Plain Truth.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.